Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kobe Tafwe. Saudi Arabia has, for the past 2 years, tried to have Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to be overthrown, funding and arming insurgents on the ground while spending large sums of money on the opposition group outside the country. But is Saudi Arabia now on the outside as the Geneva II conference nears? Has the U.S. and its allies realized a political solution is the only way forward? On this debate, we'll discuss why Saudi Arabia is so keen in having Assad overthrown and also look at its regional role and in other countries such as Bahrain, Egypt, Lebanon, and Iraq.
Syria's envoy to the United Nations, Bashar al-Jafari, says Saudi criminals are among the militants fighting the Syrian government. He says a large number of Saudi nationals fighting against Damascus were either on death row or sentenced to life in prison back home. Jafari also says Saudi intelligence chief Bandar bin Sultan is well aware of the Saudi militants' presence in Syria. Damascus has time and again accused Riyadh of fueling the ongoing crisis in Syria through arming and funding militants who include al-Qaeda-linked groups. The presence of these groups has now raised concerns even among American intelligence officials, with a New York Times report saying that the militants allied with al-Qaeda could establish a base in Syria which threatens Europe. Syria is not the only country where Saudi Arabia is playing a destructive role. In Bahrain, Saudi Arabia sent troops and armored vehicles back in early 2011 to crush a pro-democracy protest movement in the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Since then, Riyadh has been assisting the Manama regime in its brutal crackdown on protesters. Protests for change also erupted in Yemen in 2011, but they came to an end a year later without popular demands being met. Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., pushed for transferring power to a person from Ali Abdullah Saleh's regime, which Yemenis had demanded its downfall. Also in 2011, Saudi Arabia helped militarily and financially NATO's war on Libya to oust Muammar Gaddafi's regime. The conflict destroyed much of the North African state's infrastructure and killed many people. The Saudi sedition didn't spare Egypt either. Riyadh helped topple Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, earlier this year and openly supported the country's army-backed interim government. Egypt has witnessed deadly, unabated violence ever since Morsi's ouster in July. Saudi Arabia also stands accused of playing a negative part in its northern neighbor, Iraq. Baghdad has accused Riyadh of fueling a wave of unrest that has hit Iraq over the past months. In Lebanon, Saudi Arabia faces accusations of supporting extremist Takfiri groups blamed for violence that has recently gripped the country. Regarding Iran, Saudi Arabia supported the West's pressure on Tehran over its nuclear program. Although Riyadh welcomed a nuclear deal between Iran and the P5+1 last month, it appears that it was only a cover for worries in the kingdom, as Saudi foreign policy adviser Abdullah Al-Askar expressed concern about the agreement. Saudis in the past had spoken out against the rapprochement between Iran and the U.S. Saudi Arabia's intentions for causing troubles in other countries become more noticeable when its recently emerged alliance with Israel is brought into the limelight. The unholy alliance seems to be founded on one thing, moving against other nations' benefits to safeguard their own internal interests.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Debate. Author and historian Webster Griffin Tarpley joins us from Washington. And we have political analyst Jihad Morokata, who joins us from Beirut. Let me first start with you, Webster Griffin Tarpley. On the matter of insurgents, Prince Bandar is unleashing the worst criminals and terrorists inside Syria, millions of dollars to arm and train this new force by the name of Jaish al-Islam, or JAI, a union of 43 groups. Tell us your reaction on this and what is going on when it comes to Saudi Arabia and this group particular, which is a union, from what I understand, of 43 groups.
Well, I think we have to look at Saudi Arabia over a period of time. Saudi Arabia, of course, is an absolute monarchy of a type that really does not exist anywhere else in the world. If we look at Europe, you have to go back to continental Europe before 1789, before the French Revolution, to find anything comparable to Saudi Arabia. But even there, the European feudal monarchy was nowhere near as absolute as the Saudi monarchy today, right? Saudi Arabia is a country with literally no rights to do anything. It is, of course, an oligarchy. It has a royal family of several thousand members, and this makes it extremely difficult for any internal reforms to go through because the oligarchs fight against each other, right? They fight among themselves. Very hard to reform such a system. And it's extremely backward from so many points of view. The native population apparently doesn't like to work. They like to get foreigners to come in and do the work. And this creates, of course, a tremendous vulnerability for them. They've got to maintain a domestic police state to prevent the domestic workers, the foreigners that they've brought in, the aliens. And, of course, they have a large Shiite minority, which is treated very badly in the eastern provinces. So it's extremely unstable. And what they've done over the years is to reach out to the most backward, the most benighted, the most violent, the most destructive groups that they can find. And they've always done it together with the United States, right? Going back to Afghanistan in the early 1980s, when it was Saudi Arabia and the United States jointly creating al-Qaeda. So what we know as al-Qaeda is without any doubt a joint Saudi-U.S. Creation. Now, this is going into crisis for a number of reasons. And the big thing that we saw is Obama's reluctance, his refusal ultimately to bomb Syria, at least so far. And at that point, there's a kind of explosion of instability inside the Saudi oligarchy itself. They continue to back these extremely violent groups. There's a lot of speculation here about what the Saudi polity, the Prince Bandar in particular, the leading figure, is going to do. If the Syrian rebels, the Nusra and Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, if these groups seem to be losing, the scenario that's been floated here is that Prince Bandar and company will start giving them more and more modern weapons. And with those modern weapons, it's quite likely that these Nusra people will begin to shoot down Western airliners, Israeli airliners, other kinds of targets that will cause this entire thing to explode, revealing the tremendous role of Saudi Arabia in sponsoring terrorism. Now, again, I stress, not alone with the CIA, but certainly they've had a very big role. And the case that you just cited is a good case in point.
Well, we need to add more details behind this as we have it here, Jihad Morakadeh, and I'd like to understand this a little bit more because it's very confusing. Now, this force is said to be 5,000 to 50,000 in number. It actually excludes al-Qaeda affiliates like the Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham and Jabhat al-Nusra, but it embraces these Salafi units trained with Pakistani help. It makes the issue very, very confusing. Tell us, if you can, Jihad Morakadeh, what insurgent groups is Saudi Arabia supporting and arming? Are they using this group to fight against the al-Qaeda? Because our reports indicate that it's going to actually exclude, as I mentioned, these al-Qaeda affiliates, like Jabhat al-Nusra.
I'm sorry, I cannot really comment on who is supporting whom and which group in Saudi Arabia or in Kuwait, whether it is the government or individuals supporting this group or that group. I think the question is fairly larger than that. The real question is not who is Saudi Arabia supporting. The real question is Saudi Arabia versus Syria, versus the regime in Syria, the regime in Syria versus the rest of the world, the United States, the role of the United States, and so on. So one must look at the bigger picture than just which group is being supported by whom. Because at the end of the day, you have certain groups supported by individuals. These groups, the day the individuals stop supporting them, in any event, the support of the individuals is not substantial enough to help them make a difference. It's only the support of governments like Saudi Arabia that could help them make a difference if indeed the United States wanted them to make a difference. But the United States is opposed to helping the rebels make a significant difference for a very simple reason. They've been calling to receive weapons and arms from the United States for quite some time, and unfortunately, the United States never delivered. It let the situation go more and more rotten until now. It cannot even push anything to happen in Syria. And it is not, Syria is not even a point on the agenda of the White House, as Susan Rice put it, because the Middle East agenda on the of the White House that Susan Rice has put forth has to do with the nuclear Iran, weapons of mass destruction, and the Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. So the Syrian issue is not really here nor there. Now, I love the doomsday scenario of Islamists with weapons shooting down airplanes. I mean, it looked pretty much like a Superman movie. And the CIA helping these people shoot down airplanes. Let's be a little bit more serious about all of this. Saudi has a role to play in Syria. Bashar al-Assad has himself drawn the Saudis in. And one must not forget that most of those people who are fighting now on behalf of the Islamists were in the jails of Mr. Assad. And he opened his jails so that they can go and fight. These people, the Islamist extremists, were in the jails of Bashar al-Assad. So let's be a little bit more objective here. And let's talk about Bashar and what is going to happen in January and Geneva too.
Well, that's Jihad Markata's view there, Webster Griffin-Tarpley. But looking at what is going on there, Jihad Markata says that this situation is kind of extreme. Well, it is just that, isn't it? And if we want to take a look at the U.S. role, explain to us what is going on. Is the U.S. with the Saudis on this deal, of which it has been mentioned based on the diplomats that Bandar is pressing the U.S. to drop its objection to supplying these anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles to this group that Saudi Arabia has formed by the name of JAI, in which in return Riyadh is encouraging the JAI to accept the authority of the U.S. Now, is the U.S. with Saudi Arabia, which goes against them pushing for the Geneva II conference, or is the U.S. using a dual-track strategy here?
Maybe we just look at the U.S.-Saudi relation over a little bit of time. This moment where Saudi Arabia threatens to dump the United States and make other arrangements is, of course, melodramatic, but not new. We had something like that in the summer of 2001, right before 9/11. The King of Saudi Arabia circulated a letter about the U.S. and Saudi Arabia at the parting of the ways. Later in 2010, we had the famous op-ed in the Washington Post by Prince Turki El-Faisal saying that if at the September UN General Assembly the U.S. didn't act in accordance with Saudi wishes, the parting of the ways. Now, we've just had another temper tantrum by the Saudis, by Bandar in person, in the last couple of weeks, that because of the refusal of the United States to start a regional war and perhaps a world war over Syria, that Saudi Arabia was fed up. And they also had this temper tantrum over their seat on the UN Security Council. Now, the CIA has done everything possible to help those rebels on the ground in Syria. Naturally, the weapons were financed by Saudi Arabia, but there were plenty of them, and they were sent in through Incirlik NATO base in Turkey with CIA officers directing the flow of the weapons to the various groups. However, last year, when the attempt in July of 2012 to decapitate the Assad government and have a military coup, when that failed, despite the best efforts of the Obama White House, there was a certain disillusionment. And now, of course, with the fall of Qusair in June and the likely fall of Aleppo, the liberation, I would say, of Aleppo from these terrorist groups, we now see that Obama has been forced to back off. And above all, the big factor here is that the American people are sick of war. They don't want to hear any stories about new wars, especially on this kind of a basis. Just on the way down to the studio today, listening to the local news radio, they developed a scenario that there are 1,500 Westerners, people from Europe and the US, who are currently fighting for the terrorist opposition in Syria. And the question is, when they come back, what will they do? And maybe they'll come back sooner rather than later. If they're disillusioned with what's going on in Syria, they may come back and attempt to start terrorist actions in Europe and the United States, which would be, according to this think tanker, not ordered by Nusra or the Islamic Emirate, but inspired by them. And that, of course, would change public opinion. One gets the impression that the powers that be here are trying to prepare public opinion that the Syrian rebels, who were supposedly heroes of democracy, are going to get back into the category of terrorists. The other thing we've seen in the past 24 hours, the London Independent writes that General Idris of the Free Syrian Army, General Idris, of course, the CIA golden boy, General Idris is saying that he may have to join with Assad to fight Nusra and the Islamic Emirate as a part of this Geneva conference. So the Geneva conference could be very bad for the Syrian rebels and therefore very bad for the international prestige of Saudi Arabia.
Well, Jed Markade, do you have a reaction to Webster Griffin Tarpley there?
Yes, of course. First of all, I have not read the article in The Independent about General Idris. If it is written by Robert Fisk in The Independent, then I have my doubts about it. Generally speaking, people are talking and talking and talking about who is coming to Geneva, who is not coming to Geneva, and so on, and Idris is going and not going. Geneva, too, is going to happen. What will come out of it is probably nothing. But it is going to happen, and there was enough pressure being put on the opposition groups to go there. Maybe al-Nusra will not go there. Maybe the army in Iraq and the Levant will not go. Maybe the people who will go there, the Assad regime will tell them, you do not represent the opposition. So basically, the Geneva II conference will take place. The real question about the Geneva II is not who is going to attend on behalf of the opposition. The real question about Geneva II is, are those who are going to attend abide by Geneva I or not? I.e., if Iran is invited, Saudi Arabia is invited, and so on and so forth. All these countries who were not in Geneva I and who did not sign the Declaration of Geneva I. And since Geneva II is there to execute the Geneva I agreement, which I have here in front of my eyes, the question is, are they going to accept Geneva I? Because if they accept Geneva I, it says very clearly that the purpose of the conference, besides stopping the fighting and so on and so forth, is to establish a government, a transitional government, a process of transition which goes through a transitional government which will have full power, full executive power, rather. Now, if the Assad regime is prepared to transfer full executive power to a transitional government, even if it includes people from his side, this is going to be the big question about
Very
Geneva
well.
One.
Let me jump in and here, Jed Markade. I apologize for this because we're just quickly running out of time. But Webster Griffin Tarpley, the big question in the larger picture is what Saudi Arabia wants from Syria. Saudi Arabia, obviously, is against any form of democracy. We're seeing, as we've seen, how it has crushed what is going on in Bahrain. It wants a government it can control in Syria, such as what it's doing in Egypt. And of course, we can have the viewpoints they have of Iran in terms of not liking Iran, because Iran, in a sense, poses a democracy.
I think
so. Isn't that what Saudi Arabia wants? Countries it can control in the region, in the bigger picture of things.
Well, I would say that in this area, the CIA agenda, the Saudi agenda, and indeed the Israeli agenda go together. And this is the idea
Excuse
of the
me,
destruction
of the
modern state.
Can you leave the CIA alone and talk about
state.
Saudi Arabia for a minute? Forget the CIA.
Well, these are closely joined.
Forget the CIA. Everything
All right,
is
we'll
CIA.
Forget the CIA. But Saudi Arabia certainly, I think, shares the idea
that
their goal
would be Saudi Arabia and their
failed
agenda.
States, micro states, mini states. In other words, the busting up of the existing countries so that the modern state would cease to exist in the Middle East, and therefore Saudi Arabia would look more viable.
Okay, we're going to unfortunately have to leave it there. I wish we had more time. Thank you very much. Author and historian Webster Griffin Tarpley there, talking to us from Washington. And Jihad Mercatus shared his thoughts. He's a political analyst from Beirut. And thank you for watching another edition of The Today. For me, Kaveh Tafi, and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.